the clockwork. There she is.
Good morning.
All right. Good morning. I call the St. Paul City Council Organizational Committee to order. As we were just saying, it is a beautiful, glorious day in St. Paul. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We have two important updates today on our committee agenda. One is an update from Ramsey County Attorney's Office. We have Ramsey County Attorney John Choi in the house. He and the team will present a public safety update from the perspective of Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And just putting in perspective, we have had reports from our Office of Neighborhood Safety, as well as from the St. Paul and Ramsey County Domestic Violence Intervention and Prevention Group, and just on kind of our ongoing conversation of how we connect the work for the best outcomes possible. We have about 45 minutes on our agenda for that item, and following that, Director Goodman from Housing and Redevelopment Authority, or PED, will be here to talk about some STAR program guideline modifications that we'll be entertaining in a few weeks. So why don't we get started and turn things over to County Attorney Choi. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Council President Bren Moen and members of the St. Paul City Council. I'm really happy to be here today, and thank you for the invitation. I think that, we have been experiencing things in our community that we haven't experienced in a long time, about the sense of fear in our community and about the rising data and the incidence of violent crime. And I think that these conversations really began in earnest, and I think the people should understand that when this all started, there was we started to have these conversations about what can we do to better address some of the things that we just had never been experiencing before. Perfect example is the thing related to carjackings. That's not even a crime, so to speak, on its own. And we never had those types of things happen in our community. And so that was something that has not only impacted here in St. Paul, but in our region, as well as across the country. And I also want to submit that I think in February of 2020, when we probably had our largest spike that month in carjackings, I also think that we were probably at our worst in our ability to solve these issues, because at that moment in time, I think city council members were getting lots of phone calls, my office was getting lots of phone calls, and we were trying to figure out what we could do. And I think always the natural tendency is always to think about who isn't doing their job or what is causing these issues to occur. And I really think that when we delve deep into that conversation, we came out of it, and I think a big part of that was through convening a kind of an informal group called the Violence Reduction Leadership Group. Back then, it met probably almost like weekly or maybe once every 2 weeks. And I really appreciate the council members here who actually took the time to come into conversation at that moment in time to learn more about the various issues, but more importantly, about the challenges that everybody faces in terms of responding to all of these. And since then, through that table that was set up, a lot of things have transpired. And so I want to talk about some of the products or the results of some of those long conversations that we've had. But I think today, as we sit here, we're in a much better place. I want to quote Hennepin County Sheriff Dawana Witt, who said when she was sworn into office that the blame game is over and we really need to start pulling in the same direction. And I think from a city perspective, a county perspective, a regional perspective, I really see that happening. And I also see some of the crime numbers going down. You should know that, the carjackings, one is too many. But we've cut that number down by half. And I believe without a doubt that those numbers are going to continue to decrease. And a lot of that work was done in collaboration, everybody working together. And I also want to give special credit to the Sheriff's Office, who has a carjacking auto theft unit in which we're participants. But the work of that unit, because I think the key is there is to actually catch the people that are doing this type of activity. We have a clearance rate, or in other words, like a solve rate for carjackings in this county of about 35%. You would think that's kind of low, but actually probably leads the nation. Across this country, people are struggling with that particular crime. And there's a whole host of reasons for that, but I think that we're doing better than in other parts of this region, far better than other parts of this region, as well as the country. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to give you an update on some of the big things, and we could, and I'll want to have some time for questions. So the first thing that I want to talk a little bit about is, as a part of the conversations and the meetings that we had through the Violence Reduction Leadership Group, we identified an important funding opportunity, which was to seek a congressional earmark for our violence reduction leadership efforts that could help us kind of focus around gun violence, group violence intervention, and also to think about what else we could do to abate the things that were happening at that time. And we were successful because of the leadership of Congresswoman McCollum to get an appropriation of $900,000. So that money has now come to the county, and our office is in charge of administering that grant. And so the way that we are spending those funds is first with the helping the Office of Neighborhood Safety with securing technical assistance through the national network at John Jay College to provide that technical assistance for the group violence intervention work that's happening. All of you have had a presentation by Brooke Blakey, I believe, in last month or last week or so. And I think that work is really starting to come to fruition. It's really tangible. I feel like I know what is happening, and I feel that the coordination at the staff level is happening, and I think that's a really good thing. So we were able to get that off the ground, and ONS, through Mayor Carter's efforts around his convening around community, was able to get, I think, the proper support for that type of work. So a third of the $900,000 went to provide that technical assistance, not only for ONS, but also for anybody else that wants to be doing this type of work. The second third of the money was invested in Rich Altieri, who is way in the back over there. He is a commander in the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. He is on executive loan to our office, and he's working full-time in our office, working on a non-fatal shooting project, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to that particular slide. And then the last third of the money was invested in community ambassadors to help with any type of intervention, violence intervention work that they're working on. And most of that work happens in St. Paul. So a lot of this investment went to the city of St. Paul, but they're out on the streets working with people that they know that are connected to some of the violence, and they're doing everything that they can to interrupt that work. So that's generally how the $900,000 has been kind of contracted out. And we haven't spent all the money, but we're in the process of doing that. But that, I think, the most important piece of it is it resulted in these things, but at the same time, it also resulted in, I think, some common understanding and agreement. I think today we can safely say that the city of St. Paul is utilizing group violence intervention types of strategies that have been proven to work. And I appreciate this council's laser focus on trying to get some of that evidence-based group violence intervention here in this community. And I think there's also other things that are happening through the county, like Healing Streets, which is more of a hospital-based intervention model. And there's probably other organizations that are employing, like, you know, a cure violence model. I think that it's not a choice between what we do. It's actually making sure that we're doing all of it. And, in fact, if you look at cities across America that have had success in violence interruption, they don't make a distinction by just choosing one. They actually throw everything that they can at fighting violence. And I feel like that is what we're doing here in this town, and I think it's starting to pay some dividends. So that's the work around the federal funding. Another part of the work, and I alluded to, was around non-fatal shootings. You know, we in St. Paul should be really proud of our St. Paul Police Department. We do something that nobody else does. We have historically have had a clearance rate of about 90%. It's dipped a little bit during the pandemic. I think it's down to about, Mark, if you can give me the slide, about 85, 86%. But that's exceptionally high. It really is. Many communities are struggling to just barely get over 50%, and most major cities across America are far less. So we're doing something right. And again, I really believe that if we want to solve crime, we have to put the resources, the investigative resources, into solving those particular crimes. And St. Paul has historically done that. I also think another part of this is in terms of solving crime, we need to have good community police relations and trust, the willingness of our community to come forward. And I think that is really good. Now, the part that we really need to work on, and I've had many conversations with Chief Henry as well as every chief in Ramsey County, and we all agree that we also have something that we do need to focus on, which is the non-fatal shootings. And what I mean by that is that somebody actually tried to kill somebody, but because of the hospital intervention or because of they were a bad shot, they didn't shoot, but somebody pulled the trigger. It is critical, if you talk to researchers and look at just crime data, that if you can't solve those crimes, you will never solve your shooting problem. And it is no doubt that in this community we have a shooting problem. We have too many guns on our streets. We have too many young people who are not making rational choices. And there's a whole host of other things that are driving the violence. But it starts with the ability to actually solve the crime. And in many instances, this particular crime, the way that the investigation will stall oftentimes is because the person who was shot or the witnesses that were involved don't want to participate with the police. And for lots of reasons, one of which is that they may not feel safe. They might feel that justice can be best attained through retaliation. So these are things that we have to interrupt. At the same time, I also believe that if we take an intelligence-based approach and we look at ways to solve the crime without relying heavily on the victim's testimony or other witness testimony, but there are other ways to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so those are the strategies that our office, through Rich Altieri's work of analyzing some of the cases that we have pending right now that have never been presented to our office, to evaluate how we might be able to put more resources in. Of course, another part of this is to actually get more resources to the investigative function. And there's some good news there. Through conversations that I've had with the BCA, as well as Chief Henry, we believe that there could be some state funding that could be allocated here to our community to put a greater focus on the non-fatal shootings that are going unsolved. So our clearance rate in Ramsey County, and you should assume that St. Paul's is about the same, is about 33-35%. When we take intentional effort and pull people together, other communities have actually increased their clearance rate on this particular crime. A good example would be Denver. They actually started their project at about 35%. And today they're above 50%, so they've had a 20% increase. So as a part of now that the legislature has finished their work and we're going to find out how much resource that we can get from them, we're going to convene a non-fatal shooting kind of task force for the entire county. Every chief has agreed to participate in that. And our goal will be to, number one, say out loud what our clearance rate is for this particular crime, educate the public about what's going on, connect it to our ability to stop the shootings, and then say out loud that we want to change that and get to work on allocating the resources and then coordinating all of that work to move that number up so that we can say that we're at least above 50%.
Great. And I know Ms. Naker has a question. I just would like to say I appreciate hearing this. Earlier this year, there was a report of a teacher who was nicked in the ear with a bullet.
Right.
And that's been puzzling to me since I've heard that, because in my mind, that's an attempted murder. I mean, the person was shot almost in their face.
Yeah.
So I appreciate recognizing that just because they didn't hit the target doesn't mean that the trigger wasn't pulled and there was a very dangerous situation that very easily could have ended in a homicide.
Right. So when I say non-fatal shootings, too, we should be thinking about it maybe in the context of bullet to skin, right?
Yeah. Ms. Naker.
Thanks, Council President. And Mr. Choi, this is fascinating. I really appreciate how you're always so data-driven and these numbers are really stark in terms of the difference here. I'm curious if you can say a little bit more. I was struck as you were talking about how the difference between cooperation and witness testimony in homicides versus ag assaults. Obviously, with a homicide, you don't have a victim testifying at all. And I could still see there being the interest in retaliation. So I'm wondering if you could just delve a little bit more into the issues with the investigation itself. And then last week or a couple weeks ago, we were speaking with the St. Paul Ramsey County Domestic Violence Intervention Program, and I was really struck by how they were able to increase enforcement on gone-on-arrival cases just by doing what it sounds like you're talking about, just pay more attention to it and bringing people together around it. And maybe that's what you're saying we're going to do here. But I'd just be interested in hearing more about the
issues. Thank you for that question, Councilmember Naker. And by the way, the work around gone-on-arrivals and doing better around those cases actually started when I was the city attorney a long time ago, when we had a focus around evidence-based prosecution. That's a concept that originated back in the early 2000s, where we recognized how difficult it was for a victim of domestic violence to testify in their particular case. And so we started developing investigative protocols that would really focus around gathering evidence to prove a case without necessarily that testimony. And the same thing it can be said here for the non-fatal shootings. True. And that's what I say this to people all the time. On homicide cases, we figure out a way to solve that case and present it to our office and then get a conviction, and the victim is not there to testify. So we would be working on kind of like a very intensive approach around having a lot of investigators working on and intensively working on trying to solve these particular crimes. It truly is as simple as you framed it, Councilmember Naker. It's about the resource that you put into it. And so all of you need to be thinking about and making sure that we have enough police, enough investigators to do the job. Caseloads are astonishing if you think about all the shootings that we've had in this community, right? And so it's really easy if you're really busy, if you're an investigator, to, you know, go to the hospital, and then if the victim isn't going to testify and you can't find any readily available cooperative witnesses, to put that case on the back burner and move on to your next one. And I think it's just about trying to make more of an intentional effort around me starting with saying that I am very interested in these types of cases as the prosecutor, and I am going to do what I can to help the investigative agencies figure out ways to get adequate resources to solve these crimes. There's research out there that suggests that your inability to solve these crimes encourages more shootings. And I think also, too, I want to focus on this because I think that our focus has been a lot about, like, what happens after, like, what happens in the court system or what happens in the prosecution office. So those inquiries and those things are relevant to all of it, but the most important thing is what we are doing or not doing around actually solving the crimes that matter. And this is one that truly does matter. And so this is one that, and this is not to embarrass the police. It's actually to actually lift up the police to recognize that they play a really critical role in combating gun violence. we just simply don't solve these types of cases. And so our inability to do that, I think, just exacerbates the current problem that we're in. And if you think about it, the number around shootings in this community hasn't really changed over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. But the numbers for carjacking have. They've been reduced by half, and I think a big part of it is because of the intensive resources that we have put into the investigation of those crimes and the collaboration.
Mr. Tolbert.
And on for the people that we charge and convict of homicide, how many of them are you seeing that even if they're not convicted of an ag assault prior, there's a good suspicion that they were involved with it? Do you see that common thread between the people committing ag assault or unsuccessfully murdering someone and then...
Well, then committing a homicide?
Then committing a homicide.
I don't know that I've actually done that analysis or research, but I think it would stand to reason that if you're not being caught after you've shot somebody, might do it again. But I don't have a specific stat or data point on that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So, the project around non-fatal shootings. Again, I have talked to every police chief in this county. They're very supportive. We're going to go work with the state to try to find some more additional investigative resources and employ a number of best practices. We're looking to get technical assistance. In fact, I think we do have technical assistance through the Joyce Foundation at the University of Pennsylvania, I believe, right? And also, too, I just recently joined the board of the National Policing Institute, which is a national organization that does provide a lot of technical assistance for police agencies across the country. And through, I think, those relationships, we'll be able to see if we can figure out ways to continue some of the work that St. Paul has been working on. They have gotten technical assistance from the National Policing Institute to form a Crime Gun Intelligence Center, or CGIC. Chief Henry may have talked to you about this in the past, but that grant expired. But I think some of the best practices that that approach of working with our federal partners can also lead to some of that evidence-based approach to solving some of these crimes. So moving on to the next piece, another part of...
Mr. Ballinger.
I was curious as if there was a team or... if there was anyone that was kind of tracking where these young people are getting these guns.
Yeah, thank you.
If they get caught with them, is it traced back to the owners or the person that bought them?
Yeah, thank you, Councilmember Ballinger. And I think that's a really important conversation and work that needs to be built out. And I think that should be a part of our non-fatal shooting project. Because I think with the technologies that exist today, we should be able to better understand the life of a gun. And it really does matter in our ability to track some of that. Now, the federal government will do more of those types of investigations or prosecutions. But unless we're connected with them, with the United States Attorney's Office as well as the FBI, I don't think that we're necessarily focused on the investigations of those things. I think more so in the after-action type of understanding of kind of how that gun was used. But I think that is something that we should be looking at, which is to try to follow the path of the gun and to try to figure out ways to hold accountable those who have transferred guns or who had negligently had their firearm stolen. That's all a big part of the equation. And then, of course, on top of that, even before that, is this notion that we need to have a better sense and a better way to regulate the proliferation of guns in this community, in this country. I mean, if guns were the way to safety, we should be the safest nation on earth, but we aren't. But we have the most guns per capita of anybody else on this planet. So This past legislative session, thanks to Representative Dave Pinto, I can't remember the Senate author, but we did pass universal background checks. I think that is an important piece of the puzzle. It's not going to be the end-all, be-all to solve gun violence, but that is an important step. And then we also have passed extreme protection risk orders, which would be another piece of that. And so I'm happy about the work that the legislature finally did to overcome some of the special interests that are opposed to these types of changes. So I think those will make a difference. But also, too, I think a lot can be done if the resources are there to focus on the investigation of how the person who committed a particular crime actually got a hold of the handgun or the gun.
Thank you.
An interesting conversation yesterday with Jeannie Weigum, who leads ANSWER, the anti-tobacco coalition work, and has been very successful in the state and in the city. And she said that the key to her success was the funding from the big tobacco lawsuits, and that without that, without a committed source of funding to help the advocates do the work. And so, to your point, I continue to wonder if there's a way that we can sue the makers of the ghost guns, some of the ones that are clearly created to be untraceable, and get some resources to help those advocates do the work. Because if we could stick Jeannie on the gun lobby, we'd be in good shape. But it seems like that resource question is big and something that we need to tackle here in St. Paul, but also in our country and state.
So moving on, another part of the conversations that we had as a result of the violence reduction leadership group meetings, a lot of learning occurred about cross-jurisdiction, across agency, and across disciplines. And we heard pretty often and pretty thoroughly from judges about the lack of options that we have when we're dealing with youth behavior. And we had a really, I think, a critical meeting of the Violence Reduction Leadership Group. It was kind of a special emergency meeting. And I know that some of the council members were here for that meeting, but it was an in-person meeting in the county manager's office, where at that moment in time, there was just a lot of blaming going around. We had certain parts of our public safety apparatus saying that the reason why this is happening is because Boys Totem Town closed. And just a lot of finger-pointing at the time. But we took an entire morning to actually have a pretty intense conversation about what it is then, like, what's our path forward? What is it that we could all agree on? What could we do to pull together in the same direction? And what we heard from law enforcement pretty clearly is that we needed to have more options that would be secure, where you can't leave. So in other words, Chief Axel at the time called it a place for a timeout. But then everybody was dead set on making sure that intervention, that rehabilitation that occurred was very intensive. And we also heard that these places should be in our own community. Then we also heard very loudly and clearly from judges who said that when I am at the sentencing or disposition for a youth, oftentimes it feels like for me, and I'm not talking about murder like an adult certification case, but oftentimes it feels like for me as a judge that I really only have two options here. One is like an EJJ type of option that sends a kid to Red Wing for 6 to 9 months to a year, or electronic home monitoring. And it feels like everything in between exists on paper, but it's really not present because many of these places in greater Minnesota have workforce issues, so they have beds that don't exist or they don't have space. They also, in many instances, have told us that they don't want our kid because maybe they were there before or whatever it might be. And so the judges said that pretty loud and clear. And our chair of our board, Tristan Montes Castillo, as we were kind of struggling with this conversation, then just asked the question, you know, what is it that we want then? Do you all want to have, and she was talking more to the law enforcement people in the room, but do you want to go back to youth jails and prisons? And the resounding, and there was nobody objecting at all, but the resounding consensus was, no, we don't want that. But we need to have a better outcome around these rehabilitation efforts that we do in the juvenile justice system. And the county had already done some work around intensive therapeutic residential treatment homes. In fact, I think that was their plan to transition away from Boys Totem Town, but the pandemic hit. And so their resources and their leadership kind of got diverted away. And so that was talked about, and that was the solution, that we would have a number of these residential treatment homes. We felt like we had conversations already with our community about this. This would come from the Health and Human Services side. The door would be secure. It would be locked. And so we agreed, and we put together a bill. And in 2022, we should have had this bill funded. The speaker and the minority leader, you know, promised to both Sheriff Fletcher and I that they would fund it, but they just never got a tax bill passed. And in fact, during that legislative session, when public safety was on the minds of many, many people in this state, the legislature failed to do anything except for one thing around mental health. So we came back this legislative session, and I'm happy to report to you that we have $5 million to start these intensive therapeutic homes here in our community, and that work will begin through the county manager's office in earnest. And then on top of that, we're also getting $5 million for reentry to support families of these kids. So this investment of $10 million is really critical. Now, I want to make sure everybody understands some of the limitations, one of which is that this is post-adjudication, post-disposition, or sentencing. So this is for kids after they have been sentenced. But it provides this critical option for judges to utilize. And there are reports from around the country of how these interventions, because it's a very intensive intervention. I mean, it's more staff than there are kids oftentimes, and the services will follow the kid's home, and they recognize that, you know, that the home is really important too to support, and so they're working with parents. But there are a number of these interventions that have been proven to be successful around the country. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to get to work on this. And it's more of a therapeutic type of model, not a correctional type of model. And it's one that stays with the young person and supports a wraparound type of approach, including the family.
Ms. Anker. Thanks, Council President. It's so encouraging to hear about this, and kudos on all of your hard work to get to this point. It obviously seemed like we needed that missing middle intervention, and now we have it. I'm curious what you would estimate the need is in terms of numbers of young people who need this service, and how far we're estimating that $10 million will go.
Well, it's hard to say because we're just starting, but we have up to five homes?
Up to seven.
Up to seven homes, right? Five. I don't know what that's going to purchase, but it's probably more like five. And again, it's post-adjudication, post-disposition. Now, we're not going to stop working on this issue. I mean, we still have another issue, which is pre-adjudication. And these would be the kids, oftentimes, who would be ruled deemed incompetent to stand trial. And so there's going to be a work group propped up to discuss this issue. One of the things that we think could be promising is to utilize these homes if we can find the right type of legal authority for a judge to utilize it, but to also have these homes built out for restoration of competency. But most importantly, it's really about the services that are badly needed. Many of the kids are coming from very traumatic pasts and have serious, serious mental health issues that need to be addressed. And so there's improvements that we can make to what was authorized here for Ramsey County, as well as developing a solution for the entire state. Now, keep in mind, you know, there was a conversation at the legislature about, well, why is it just for Ramsey County? And the reason why is because we got our ducks in a row, and we knew exactly what we wanted. We had the hard conversations in our community. We got consensus, whereas in other communities, that consensus does not exist. that there's a disparate, they're still in that place where they're trying to get that consensus and also, quite frankly, probably blaming each other for the problems that they find them, that they're challenged with.
And really, just a hat tip to you, it really takes leadership to force people to come together and say, let's stop blaming each other and focus on moving forward, because we don't have time to play this game anymore. And you did that. And so I want to recognize that and appreciate your work in that regard. And, you know, sorry, guys, we did get our ducks in a row, and we will take the funding. And you can copy our good results if you want to, but we're not waiting. Yeah. These are urgent matters, and they cannot wait. Right. Ms. Prince.
Thank you, Council President, and thank you, County Attorney Choi. This is a great presentation, and I'm pleased that this passed the legislature. I think one of my frustrations is, in terms of resources, is that we closed Boys Totem Town, I believe it was 2016 or 2017. It was when I was new on the council. And the decision at that time, which did not go forward, but plans had really progressed toward a merged facility with Hennepin County that nobody I knew thought was a good idea. But at that point, there was a budget for Boys Totem Town. There was a budget that was prepared to build this new facility. There's always been some level of corrections funding for juveniles. So how did we end up with no money to move any of these ideas forward except to get a legislative appropriation?
Councilmember Prince and Councilmember President, I just want to make sure that the record is correct. The decision that the county board made to close Boys Totem Town was actually in 2019.
Okay.
And it was later in the year. And we have to keep in mind that in March of 2020, the pandemic happened. Mm-hmm. And I think you knew this from the city's perspective and certainly from the county's perspective. I can tell you that everything from an operation standpoint and a planning standpoint shifted towards responding to the coronavirus pandemic. We were dealing with serious homelessness issues. We were dealing with just all of those things relative to that. And I just think what happened was it got put on the back burner. With regard to the financing, I don't know what happened. That's a I don't control the county budget, nor do I even control my own budget, other than after it's been appropriated to me, right? Mm-hmm. But I do believe that when we shift and make these changes, it's really critical to capture those savings. I think one of the common criticisms of Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, that, by the way, started in 2005,
right.
And nobody ever said a word about it. In fact, it was celebrated. Chief Tom Smith was the co-chair of JDAI for a long time. But when that started back in 2005, and you could see some of the operational change, you know, we used to have, you know, over 100 kids at any one moment in detention, pre-adjudication, pre-conviction. That number went down to anywhere between about 50 to 30 kids per day, right? I think now the number might be a little bit higher, maybe 35, the last time I checked. We didn't capture those savings. And the criticism has been that where is that alternative, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe, so there was an opportunity, but keep in mind, 28, 29, 2010, if any of you were around, that's when we had the recession. And we had lots of financial issues back then. So maybe that's what happened there. But more importantly, you know, thinking about, I mean, if we could, in hindsight, go back and dissect all of these decision points and think about the missed opportunities, and there were some. But more importantly, we're here today in 2023. Mm-hmm. We have to find a path forward. And so I will just say this about all of that, is that if there's any opportunity that we can go back and revisit some of those past decisions, one of the things that I think is sorely missing in this community, and it relates very directly to public safety, not so much on the violent crime, but just on providing opportunities and support for families and youth, we I believe that we need to have a dedicated 24/7 type of service center than anybody in this community. It's just very clear that if you're a parent and you're struggling, you got a 16-year-old that you just don't know how to deal with anymore and you want some help, that there's a place and there are services available for you. If you're a police officer and you see young people who shouldn't be out at night at 1 o'clock and instead of just driving by, maybe you could give them a ride to the service center and then the community could just get to work. They don't have to come into the criminal justice system. That is something that I've always been an advocate for. We tried back in 2012 and 2013. That conversation did not go very far. But perhaps it's an opportunity to think about that and also making sure that we have clear alternatives for people. I've had too many conversations, Councilmember Prince, with moms who are just desperate for services, and the only thing that they can think of is for the system to arrest their kids. And we have to acknowledge that we don't have clear resources available. What I mean by clear is just like it's obvious, like if we were the victim of a crime, we know what to do. We would call 911. If you're a struggling parent, anybody who knows that this young person needs some assistance or help, there is no clear path. Good luck, because it's going to be a maze to try to find out how you're going to connect to the needed services that you have. And so as a community, I would love for us to be investing in that and investing in recreation centers and opportunities for kids and families. Those are the most important things that we can do to, I think, keep our kids off the path that I don't want them to come to my attention because it's oftentimes almost too late.
Thank you.
Ms. Prince, I appreciate the question and asked Director House if she could follow up with Ryan, too. I think it's a good question. There was dedicated funding for Totem Town or for those from Ramsey County itself, and so we'll redirect the question to the Ramsey County Board and Ramsey County to understand, you know, obviously the commitment is there for this work, and there is a funding path that was utilized in the past. So we'll bring that to the board.
And to your point, I got a call just the other day from a mom who called the police to help her son in trouble, and it did not go in the right direction. And yeah. So I really appreciate your vision for that. And I'm wondering, is there an example in another city, or is this something that...
They're all over. You could look across the river. They have one. I don't know if they've had the best outcomes from there. But I suggest that you start with the Husky Report. When we started and launched JDAI, we had consultants from the Annie Casey Foundation that helped launch and advise and provided technical assistance for our efforts. And in their report, we launched, their strong recommendation was for us to have a youth service center for kids and families. But we never did that.
All right. I saw Ms. Yang has a question up, and just a time check that we have probably about, I don't know, 15 minutes left.
Awesome. Thanks, Council President. Well, County Attorney Troy, I want to say thank you so much for your leadership. These are really big wins that we definitely need to be celebrating, and I know that we are. And I feel like in order to get it done, it really takes leaders to be bold, leaders to be innovative, and to really think about what it is that the community wants us to be doing and what do they need. And so I really feel like that is the leadership that you have been always showing our entire community and leading with. And so I want to say thanks and commend you and your staff for all of your work. I was wondering, for one of the bullet points here, youth restorative justice, it says $8 million statewide. So all the other amounts, $5 million, $5 million, $8 million, those are for Ramsey County. Is that right?
Thank you for that. First of all, thank you for your really kind words, Councilmember Yang. And that was the next thing I was really excited about to celebrate is that I think, heard from Erica Schumacher from my office present about some of the work that we're doing around our Reimagine Justice for Youth and our collaborative review team. And a big part of that is relying very heavily on a restorative model as opposed to the historical and traditional model of an adversarial process where we put a case into the system and my goal is to ultimately get a conviction. Instead, we're focused really on the restoration of the young person who was involved in the offense and the person that was harmed, and really doubling down on utilizing restorative justice as a path forward to minimize the harm and also improve the outcome for the youth, right? And so this $8 million statewide appropriation is to actually jumpstart kind of what we're doing in Ramsey County across the state to really utilize restorative justice. And I know Councilmember Ballinger knows full well the power of what restorative justice can do to change behavior and to get just kids starting to care about themselves and taking care of themselves and then taking other steps forward to make better choices, right? So this money will create a new state office of restorative justice that will be in place to support every community across the state to employ these types of strategies in their systems, whether it's the criminal justice system or the child protection system. And it will provide grant funding up to $500,000 for new new projects for communities or support ones that already exist. And so we have been on this path of reimagining justice for youth for a long time, about 4 years, but we started our collaborative review process back in July of 2021. And maybe if people are listening, we have a website that has all of the information and data. It's probably too much. But we also have an evaluation from the University of Minnesota Medical School, and it evaluated the first year of experience for the collaborative review team. But we're getting better outcomes than what we'd had in the traditional system. The most exciting thing is that we're actually making a difference around racial disparity. Because one of the things that I've always struggled with is that to get kids to actually succeed in diversion, there was massive disparity, about 25% gap between black and white. But this collaborative review approach, working with our community, employing restorative justice, has actually improved those numbers in the right direction. And so I'm really happy about that, and we're going to continue to get that right. It's a learning process because nobody else is really doing this in this state or across the country, so we're kind of building it as we fly, but we're committed to the evaluation. And these resources that are now available, I think we should be first in line since we have kind of established this model to get some of the funding to keep the momentum going and to have our outcomes. And the evaluation that we just did and that we will continue to do for the next 10 years is to, in my elevator speech, I always say that what we do as a part of utilizing restorative justice in this collaborative review process, I want to get better outcomes than we did over the past 10 years backwards, because that was a part of the research that the University of Minnesota did to see how many kids would actually end up in our adult prison system, how many kids ended up coming back over and over to the youth justice system. So we have all of that data. So starting from July of 2021, my goal for the next 10 years is to beat that data in terms of outcomes. And right now, over the course of the first year and a half, the report has come back to saying that around actually succeeding with the intervention, we're doing better, and we've also addressed racial disparity. And so these resources will be great. I also rang the alarm bell with our law enforcement leaders in this state about the fact that we are struggling with charging some cases and completing investigations because the turnaround time for our forensic lab is taking way too long. In fact, the average time is about 150 days on average to get DNA prints back from a gun. And oftentimes we can't charge a possession case without that type of DNA. The laboratory got $8 million, so that will make a difference. I also want to note that I put my money where my mouth is and got civil asset forfeiture dollars together, and we're funding a year's worth of priority for Ramsey County so that we can have priority for our cases over other parts of the state. We shouldn't have to do this, but I felt like we needed to do that on top of what St. Paul Police already provides to the BCA through a memorandum of understanding. I just don't think that local units of government have to fund themselves to butt in front of somebody else. And so this $8 million was not the full appropriation that the governor had requested, but it will, I think, alleviate some of the backlog that we have for the, especially on the gun testing. And then finally, both Sheriff Fletcher and I, along with sheriffs and county attorneys, were very concerned about the change that the administration had proposed around the 48-hour rule. 48-hour rule, for those of you who don't know, it's a law that was put in place more than a decade ago to recognize that people who have serious mental health issues should not be in our jails and that they need to be in a hospital. Sadly, and I think one of the greatest human rights atrocities happening in this community as well as in across the state is that we have people with serious mental illnesses who are just getting worse, who are in solitary confinement because they have to be there 23 out of the 24 hours because they have to be separated from the general population. They're in our jails, and a judge has ordered this person to go to the Anoka Hospital. But because of the problems that we have with workforce and the lack of beds capacity, this law for the past 10 years has been ignored by the commissioner or whoever the human services director was. And so we brought this to the attention of the legislature. And sadly, the commissioner, I think, wanted to have a respite from the 48-hour rule. So the 48-hour rule for the next 2 years only starts when there's a bed available, which means that there really isn't a rule anymore. There is no pressure anymore to get a bed available. But some of the good things that happened as a result of this is that there were some concessions made. There will be a task force that will be in place. It's only for a two-year period. And hopefully by next session, we will have some legislation. This is one of the most serious issues that we have in our community, especially as it affects the criminal justice system and also our local emergency rooms. So we've got to figure out a way to get this right. We'll continue to work on this and work in collaboration with the administration, and hopefully we can figure out a way to deal with this situation. But also, too, we need to also deal with the youth mental health issues, and that's the work that's also going to happen during the interim with the County Attorneys Association and other stakeholders as well. Moving really quickly, because I know we're running out of time, but this is another really exciting thing. I believe that public safety really boils down to making sure that we have legitimacy in what we do and also having good community relations. I think all of you will remember back in September of 2021, along with other partners. Let me go to the next slide. Your own St. Paul Police Department and the City of Roseville and St. Anthony Police and the Maplewood Police Department, we all made a change back in September of 2021, recognizing that focusing on traffic enforcement, utilizing equipment violations, maybe as a way to do further investigations, doesn't really result in the things that we thought that it did. And in fact, it actually undermines the trust between police and in our community. And at that time, we talked also about the fact that there was a substantial disparity of 4-to-1 for black motorists who were subject to this type of stop and equipment violation, as well as a consent search. We were also committed to research. And so through a partnership with the Justice Innovation Lab at George Washington University, and also with funding from the St. Paul, Minnesota Foundation, we've developed out some alternatives for our police who are aligned with this change, who also made the change. And St. Paul Chief Axel sent out an email and did roll call training to all of his officers. And the police department in St. Paul and in Roseville has been hard at work trying to develop an alternative, working with our 911 communication center, where we can, instead of pulling somebody over for a seen or observed equipment violation, we can enter that into the CAD system. It will generate a report back to the police department, and then they can do a letter to the owner of the vehicle and offer a lights on coupon to take care of the defective equipment violation or help find assistance with the tabs. And this work was kind of launched the beginning part of this year. The research is now back. We'll be able to talk about the research more publicly, but I want to just, this looks like really great news, is that everything that we had said that we wanted to accomplish, and so we said what we wanted to accomplish was to eliminate or reduce these equipment violations, We said that we wanted to see a greater reliance or stressor on the traffic safety that matters, like speeding and drunk driving, that would be prioritized. We said that we wanted to handle or tackle the racial disparity head on, that 4-to-1 disparity that we had. And we said that we wanted to build out an alternative, right? All of those things have been accomplished. In fact, the disparity has been cut in half for the traffic stops, the equipment violations. And then on the consent searches, more than 50%. So this is really significant work. Through the over the past month here in May, I have been meeting with our NAACP in St. Paul. I've met with African American Leadership Council, Black Ministers Alliance, as well as all of the police chiefs across Ramsey County, including your chief Axel Henry. And they were very pleased with the research that came back. It will be published in the beginning part of June. There'll be a number of law review articles. There'll be a public website that George Washington University, through their Justice Innovation Lab, will publish, as well as the Vera Institute for Justice. But this is really tremendous work on the part of our law enforcement, because what they said they wanted to change will change, has changed. And more importantly, there are a number of agencies that were not aligned with this change. They did absolutely nothing, and their data suggests that nothing changed. Their level of traffic stops remained the same. Their level of disparity remained the same. So in June, we'll be able to announce some new agencies in Ramsey County who will now become aligned with St. Paul Police and others. But this is the path forward to build better community and police relationships, a better version of justice in this town. And so I want to thank all of you. Some of you, I think, were at that announcement, but more to come on that, but I'm just really excited about that.
Great. Ms. Prince, looks like you had something to add.
That is just fantastic news, and it's interesting because yesterday at my coffee shop, one of the people who's kind of more critical of the things I'm engaged in said to me, so what's happening with that, with not prosecuting things that come out of traffic stops? And I said, I think there's a good report coming out. I'm very excited about it, and thank you for...
Yeah, and if I can say one last thing just as to all of you as elected officials, I think it's really important that we push back on this narrative that we have to make choices. They're really false choices that somehow we can't delve deeply and intentionally around trying to improve racial disparities, and somehow if we do that, that will come at the expense of public safety. I think we need to have every tool on the table, and addressing head-on racial disparity is an important part of the public safety strategy. We can't go on like this. I invite all of you to go to the first appearance in our court system, and the disparities are stark. And you all know the economic and the other types of disparities that we have in our community, but we just can't go on like this. And so we have to make the choice to do everything to improve safety, to improve justice, and that means that we don't have to make these false choices that oftentimes people present to us. And I think it's really important that we as elected officials make that clear to the aspect of our community that is pushing back on that reform somehow, that somehow we have to make a choice. We don't. In fact, by doing all of it, we're actually going to have a better version of safety and justice in our community.
Ms. Nicker.
Thanks, Council President. Mr. Choi, I also want to share Councilmember Prince's thanks for this remarkable presentation. And I really want to applaud the way that you not only use data to decide what to do, but then once you've taken that decisive action, often really bold, courageous action, like the one you just described, you take the time to partner with research institutions so that we get data on the back end of that. Because I think it's very powerful, and I hope that I'm looking forward to seeing this report, to counter some of those prejudiced and ignorant statements with not just this is pie in the sky, hopeful, progressive ideology, but it's actually based in fact, and we've taken the chance to find that out. So I really appreciate it, and I'm just very grateful to have you in the role that you're in.
Thank you.
Other comments? Thank you for joining us and for your leadership. As you've heard, there's a lot of support behind and alongside the work you're doing. We see ourselves as partners with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office and hope that we can have you back early and often. This has been a very good presentation, and I think we often believe that our platform here is a good opportunity to share the good work we're doing. And so I see some presses in the audience, and hopefully they're picking up and helping us with that narrative as well, is the leadership here and what we're doing, and that we're, again, ahead of the curve. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
All right, we'll just have a quick changing of the guard.
I have an old
is that what it is?
Laptop that I'm getting a new one next week.
Oh,
this one doesn't hold a charge.
You can have smoke in your car.
Welcome, and thanks for we extended our first half of this presentation a bit long. Hopefully, the folks who strolled in from PED got a good earful of what's happening in the county attorney's office. Sometimes those happenstance situations are like, oh, that was enlightening to know about that. We should have made them stick around for this, right? Here's what we're doing in PED, John.
Let's see if we can get the voice showing.
Yep. Here we go.
Excellent. Let's go back to the beginning.
All right, Director Goodman, take it away.
Good morning, Chair Bryn Mowen, Commissioners, Council. See, you're different bodies for me everywhere I go. Council members, it's good to see you this morning. We are here this morning to give an update on some recommended guideline changes for the STAR program, Cultural STAR, Neighborhood STAR. I have with me Erin Lewis, who is our new Neighborhood STAR program coordinator. She's been here a month, I believe. So you may or may not have met her before, but we are thrilled to have her. Nora Riemenschneider, who is our arts and culture coordinator, who's been managing Cultural STAR for
6 years.
6 years. So happy to be here today. Also some additional staff from PED and who support these programs in the room, as well as I'll acknowledge Charlie Vanderotter is here, the chair of the Neighborhood STAR board. So thank you for being here. We'll get going. We don't have a lot of time this morning. We've been talking about this for quite a while and kind of examining this program over the several years that I've been here, and then just looking back, doing a look back. Several things have become apparent. The administrative lift for each round of applications is high. It's a lot of work among across multiple departments, but primarily ours for the application process. The administrative lift for each award, especially small awards. The small awards is just as much for the larger awards. So when I kind of did a back of the napkin calculation of staff time across several departments over several years, sometimes that amount of staff time is more than far more than the amount of the award, especially for loans. Many of the STAR loans are the loans that become past due. They might need restructuring or end up being written off. So when you look at it, like our outstanding loan portfolio, the STAR loans create a lot of work, a lot of tails with work related to the loans. We also know that the required match, and you all have brought this up before, presents significant challenges for certain applicants or potential applicants, and the compliance requirements once selected are often present significant challenges for awardees. So based on these findings and discussions we've had with you all and among ourselves and with others, we are recommending several adjustments to the STAR program guidelines for this year, for 2023. For Neighborhood STAR, and these are, I will tell you that these are going to sound like not a lot of change, but there are big changes in the equity piece and in the administrative piece. So it feels like I'm not asking for much change, but they really will make a big difference. We are proposing to go to a grants-only program for Neighborhood Star versus loans. We are proposing to increase the minimum grant request to $15,000 from $5,000 and eliminating the match requirement for grant requests up to $50,000. There are occasionally small, I mean, the needs for the small grants, it's not suggesting that there aren't ever small needs, but we believe that either there's a better resource than something as administratively heavy as coming through the city or HRA, or perhaps in some cases, for example, the district council will apply for $50,000 and they'll administer a smaller grant program. So from us, our award minimum threshold, we would like to recommend $15,000.
And you may be getting to this, but just on the first recommendation, I'm very supportive of going away from the half loan, half grant, and all the, you know, it's very convoluted. That said, I'm curious to know what the grant only means. Mm-hmm. A lot of granting that I've seen has it's forgivable after a certain amount of time, or if after 3 years, half of it is forgivable. So it's not just a full-on giveaway. So there's some criteria that the investment we're making is for the long haul. And so I'm just curious what kind of, on this change with grants only, what would be those parameters?
Chair Brimon, that's an excellent question. Even with our Cultural Star grants now, we give a certain amount up front and then they have to submit paperwork. A forgivable loan creates just as much loan paperwork as a not forgivable loan. So we wouldn't go, I don't think, the loan route. The administrative piece, like kind of the procedural piece, is certainly something that we can look at. But as far as whether or not it's a grant or a loan document that requires credit analysis and all the various loan documents and loan administration, we're looking for grants. That's not to say that someone would just be handed the money. They would still have requirements to provide records and all the, you know, there's still a lot of work there. It's not you apply and we hand you the money and you do your thing. It just eliminates the loan administration piece.
And if I said forgivable loan, I apologize. I guess I meant forgivable grant.
I mean, grant, yeah.
as in if somebody gets a $30,000 grant from the city and then the next afternoon sells their facility to somebody else.
Certainly.
Do we have a lien? You know, is there any sort of, or is it, I feel like that's the...
Chair
Brimon, there needs to be some cap on the back.
That's a fair question. And I should have said, too, we're here to discuss and ask questions today, and we'll be bringing this back on June 7th. So these are certainly subject to change. So thank you for the questions. Thank you in advance for the questions and comments. I will say that, again, a grant in my head is a grant. It's so forgivable. They're all forgivable, right? It's a grant. But are there clawbacks? Are there requirements? Certainly. Those can be the kinds of things that we could look at. We could look at clawbacks. We could look at a time requirement. We could look at any amount of procedural requirements, noting that every one of those requires more tracking, right? So we've got to find that balance between the amount of the award and the amount of administrative lift it is to go forward. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
I have a question.
Oh, Ms. Jalali.
Thank you for this. My question is around how we sourced like grantee and star award recipient feedback to inform these things. Obviously, staff are, you know, on the administering side, and so I fully believe you and hear you when you're saying that these three individual changes like matter a lot for admin, and I get that. I also see that as like the system-facing side of it, and I realize that's important and we should include that, but how does that connect to what you've heard from businesses? Are there things that are like, are there like top two requests from businesses that we still can't or haven't or won't address? I'm trying to line up how these adjustments, which I find reasonable and very worthy and believe you about the impact, connect to, there's businesses in my ward that I've worked really hard to get a star grant, and it's like the most grateful, community aligned, like hardworking business, and they'll also say like, I love that I have this, and also this has been so extremely hard. I would love to talk to someone about changing the guidelines. Now here we are with this conversation. So I would like to understand where that feedback loop lives. That would be very helpful.
Chair Brimon, Councilmember Jalali, thank you for that question. A couple of ways. The boards have both been informed of these, and we've been talking with the boards over months and months about these things. These two program administrators, though Aaron is new, Nora's been here quite some time, and they receive feedback as well. I don't know if either of you have anything you'd like to add to that, just from hearing from specific businesses. But what, you know, we have definitely engaged the board. We know that the applicants and the often it just even just getting under contract takes so long. We still have. I can't tell you the backlog of projects we're trying to get under contract because there's so much requirements. I'm going to talk about compliance requirements and other things as well. So all of these recommendations, though I'm focusing on this, on the administrative piece, come from input from both applicants, awardees, and the boards as well.
Thank you. And just as a follow-up on that, and it's more like an ask going forward, I imagine that our neighborhood businesses and organizations receiving STAR awards have other ideas they want to share. And, like, I, as a council member, believe that that's happening. Like, that dialogue is happening informally or just, like, through the, you know, conversations with the board, et cetera. It would be great to figure out, like, what does that additional formal process look like where we can basically get it as public comment, make sure that we're hearing that, get our own businesses into that. Like, I'm just asking for even more engagement and even more changes just to be more in tune with exactly what businesses are experiencing and figuring that out. And so I think it's really just a, this is good and let's do even more of it and work more closely together, if that makes sense.
Chair Brimond, Councilmember Jalali. Yes.
Okay.
I will say that these, we are trying to get a round out this year. And so we came with what we feel like are the most clear and obvious guideline changes for this year. That is not to say that we won't make adjustments again. We typically do come back with adjustments based on feedback that we receive. So know that we will continue to consider any feedback.
Yep.
Our goal right now, as you see the timeline, is to get some guidelines approved for this year, making the kind of low-hanging fruit changes we think will make an impact on equity and administrative lift, and then continue to evaluate.
And I appreciate that practicality a lot. I think within the community, I often perceive this sense of, like, institutions, like, don't change. They don't change their practices. They, like, hear our frustration, but they don't change. And, like, I'm proud that our city does change and listen. And sometimes when something changes, it can create this perception of, like, well, since they never change and this is the one time they do, this is, like, a train at the station and this is the first time it'll come in 10 years and I'll never get it again. And, like, I'm trying to change the culture in the community of, like, being closed off. I think it would be great to say, we've found some, like, actually pretty significant ways we can improve this program that is informed by what we're hearing. And we're also looking at additional future input. And, like, we're using this as the first of some rounds. And that's really what I'm getting at. And it's really – none of that's in disagreement with what you said. I was just trying to tell you more about where I'm coming from with that based on, like, so many BIPOC businesses, small business owners fighting so hard to, like, make their business happen, get the grant, feel like – the high of getting the grant, and then it's like the party's over, and now it's time to do the compliance and, like, just going on that with them. So it just feels, like, sensitive for me based on who I'm helping. Anyway, we can keep going. I just wanted to talk to you.
Appreciate those
Thank
comments
you.
Very much.
Ms. Prince.
When you speak to the administrative lift, are you referring to within PED, or does it also trigger the other departments that have to be part of it? Because I mean, it does seem like all of our contract work seems to take way too long at the city. And whether or not we should be, while you're doing this, I mean, are there places that we should be fixing our
Chair Brimond, Councilmember Prince, as I go through this presentation, we're going to talk a bit about compliance, for example. There are other departments who are involved in each of these, depending on the kind of project. So as I go through, you'll see some recommendations. And something I want to mention, too, that is not in here as a guideline change, but we know that we haven't done as good a job, and we will make a conscious effort this year and going forward to really get the word out about these programs through the district councils. It feels like we get a lot of times the people who know are the people who know, and I feel like we haven't done as good of a job. So as soon as we're ready to launch, we are going to look for every channel and every opportunity to get this information out more broadly than perhaps it has been in the past.
I, at the risk of being a broken record, stop calling it STAR. That would probably be a great way for people to know what we're talking about if we didn't say the STAR program. What is the STAR program? In terms of getting the word out. I want to go to Ms. Yang, and then also it sounds like you are kind of, we're getting ahead of you in your presentation.
Thanks, Council President. I also agree with that because when I mentioned STAR program to folks, they get confused about whether it's neighborhood STAR I'm talking about, cultural STAR, or if it's the year-round STAR right. dollars from
Energy
our board
STAR.
Offices. Yeah, exactly. And so I know that you still have a lot to present, but I just want to make sure that what gets covered is really the feedback from the Neighborhood STAR board, because you know we are basically appointing our residents to sit on the board, and these are what I don't feel these are minor changes. These are very major changes. I do think it's necessary for us to propose new guideline changes to our program overall, and I also feel like the context you provided is really consistent with all the concerns and the barriers I've heard the past 3 years. And so Yes, we need changes, but I also want to know how the board also feels about it, like whether they've taken a vote about, you know, their approval for this and where that vote lands to.
Thank you, Chair Brimo and Councilmember Yang. So the board is a recommending body, and they did have a board meeting this week. And again, Charlie Vander Arty is here. You can correct me, but I believe the one area that we sort of differ is they really are interested in still maintaining a very small grant award threshold. And I believe there are better ways to get around to have the than have $95,000 projects, or you know, the small projects are. There are other ways we can award to district councils, or there's probably better funding sources for the very small grants. I appreciate the sentiment and the desire, but I think that's been a real sticking point. So I would say that's maybe the one departure. Is there anything else you can think of, Erin?
Just follow. Thank you for sharing about that. I feel like what we may expect in the future is that Neighborhood STAR board members might be reaching out to us about things that they feel like they're in disagreement with. And so yep. It would be really helpful to know what those things are if you find out more along the way. But, you know, for any folks who reach out to me, then, you know, I will definitely be open to having a conversation with them.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember. I'm going to go ahead and try to move through. I won't read through the budget. I think you've already seen it. But just to remind you that the this is the Neighborhood STAR budget for this year. The pending closeouts could get a little bit higher because we still have some awards that we think are probably not going to get under contract or not move forward. So that number could get a little bit higher. And this is a timeline, and again, I won't read everything. I did send this out to you last night, but you'll see if we can bring this to you on June 7th and get moving as fast as we can, we won't have approval still towards the end of November. So we really want to get moving so that we can have a 2023 round that actually happens in 2023. So this is the proposed timeline for Neighborhood STAR. Cultural STAR, with the change in formula. With the change in formula, not change, but correction in formula. The total amount of budget for Cultural STAR is less going forward of the total. And again, when I mentioned the lift for each round, there's really I'm not sure why we did two rounds of Cultural STAR, but it really doesn't make sense to do two rounds with a $1 million budget. So we're planning on doing one round each year like we do with Neighborhood STAR. The Cultural STAR applicants are often repeat applicants. They know the program. They can adjust to this. They can plan ahead for this. So I'm not concerned about that. In this case, we're increasing the minimum grant request to $10,000 from $5,000. I would say the reason for the difference is that these are programmatic, often not capital improvement projects as much as some of these are performances and other things that just don't have as much paperwork or it's not like a capital improvements program project that's being built. So it makes sense. I appreciate that it's different, but it does make sense to us. Eliminating the batch requirement again, which has been a difficulty for even people wanting to be able to apply. The dates that you see there are nothing changes about how we've done it. We're just laying out what the dates would be for the special projects have until May 31st of 2025. And the capital projects have 2 years. So one has a 1 year contract term, one has a 2 year contract term. So essentially the same kind of thing. Raise the minimum, eliminate the match. In this case, we'll just go to one funding round per year, just like we do with Neighborhood STAR. And then you see the budget.
Is there any reason why we're saying 15 for neighborhood and 10 for cultural?
Yep. Council President Brimo, and that's what I was trying to explain is like a $15,000 capital project, like a project, like we're building something. That's a, you know what I mean?
For performances.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep. Thank you for asking.
Ms. Nanker.
Thanks, Council President. Director Goodman, I'm noticing that you had $250,000 for admin costs for Neighborhood Star, and it looks like zero for admin costs for Cultural Star. Can you explain that
why?
Zero, yes. And what's the total cost of administering STAR?
Certainly. Oh, gosh. Chair Brimo and Councilmember Nanker, I don't know off the top of my head what the total cost for administering STAR is, but we can make that calculation for you. That said, Nora, we had carryover from last year that we used for this year for the administrative fee costs for Cultural STAR, so we just had budgeted more than we needed for last year. That's the only reason why we don't have to budget as much as we did this year.
So is it fair to say that just keeping it to PED's admin costs normally Cultural STAR is $75,000?
Chair Brimo and Councilmember Nanker, I would say that's what we budget for it. That's probably not what it costs. Like, we don't have we don't get enough, right? We have a certain amount we can use from the STAR, STAR funding to pay for admin costs, but it certainly doesn't cover our admin costs. It goes toward our admin costs. Does that make sense? It's a percentage that we can use.
So do you know what the total cost for PED to administer Cultural and Neighborhood STAR, just PED, is? That's what you're saying you don't know?
No, I don't have a number off the top of my head. We have done a lot of number crunching, so I could get you something that's order of magnitude. I just don't have that with me today.
I think it's helpful just for like a side-by-side. Even if last year we didn't have the same cost because of surplus or something, just to understand what it really costs.
I'll tell you, Chair Brimo and Councilmember Nanker, I did like a back-of-the-napkin calculation a couple of years ago on a $5,000 Neighborhood STAR loan. And it was something like 75 hours over 5 departments over 3 years. 75 hours of staff time over 5 departments over 3 years, or something along those lines. Not counting, you know, that was like the baseline. So for a $5,000 grant, it's a lot if you start to break down all the work that goes into these. And that doesn't even count, you know, all the volunteer time and all the time for – there's a lot there.
So when it comes in front of us, maybe if we can get it off
sure.
the napkin and
yep.
onto a doc.
Just as a quick follow-up, the reason I'm asking the question, and I know we're talking really fast and trying to move really quickly,
yep.
but these are important. As long as we are thinking critically about the program and efficiencies, which I'm really glad we're doing, we have talked – a lot of us have talked about this before, that, you know, the city is not the easiest place to get money from. We are not a grant-making institution. We make grants, but we don't do them very well. We spend a lot of time and money on them. That's not a fault of any of ours. It's just we're not – a city is not really built to do that.
Right.
We have wonderful grant-making institutions in our community.
Indeed.
Some of which were just on the slide that Mr. Choi was showing. And I am curious if, alongside these changes – you have considered having a conversation with the St. Paul, Minnesota Foundation about creating a donor-advised fund with our STAR money that could still be advised by the Neighborhood STAR Board. It could still operate the way it does. But I would hazard a guess that the administrative fee for something like that and that arrangement would be far below what we're spending now. And I don't want to piecemeal changes when we're trying to reconfigure, rejigger something that just isn't built to do what we're talking about when there's another way.
Yep, Chair Brimo and Councilmember Nanker, we certainly have talked about that. We have not gotten deep into conversations with anyone, but as I mentioned, we do believe that that's the answer to the smaller grants for certain, something along those lines. We also, as a city, it's even harder for us to do. We're not lenders, right? So it is definitely not the easiest way to get money into these projects, but we're here, we have it, we want to participate, but I believe for the smaller grants, we certainly should partner with other organizations.
And I think even for the bigger grants, I think this is...
Really?
I think they make very big grants, and yeah. I think this is a conversation that should be had while we're talking about this.
That's helpful feedback. Thank you. Yeah.
And I just, we will create time to finish the conversation, so don't feel rushed. I do want to just remind people that I think this is a conversation about not letting perfection be the enemy of good. And we have a STAR round that's about to go out, and the STAR board has said that a lot of these changes reflect the recommendations the STAR board has made, such as going with a grant program. I know there's some discrepancy about the low number, but also we're trying to get the resources out the door to the communities that we're trying to serve. And you've heard me say it 10 million times, I cannot spend STAR money in Ward 5. I can't with the current rules. And so But Mr. Lloyd is looking at this with in concert with the people who are doing Cultural and Neighborhood Star, and with the Star Board, a bigger conversation about the whole program. And I don't think that we can solve that before this round goes out. And I, for one, I'll just say I'm supportive of making it easier for our businesses, particularly our businesses in areas where English is not first language, to get these dollars to where we want them. And without these adjustments, I think we're going to continue to have problems. But fully agree that as we move into the larger conversation about where are we headed with Star Neighborhood and Star Cultural, that looking at those other methods make a lot of sense. I don't think that we're going to get that solved
this round.
So just to kind of reframing like what we're trying to do with these minor adjustments that'll have a major impact. And I just, for one, know that I've heard them from the board, from council members, and from our community as simple ways that we can make the dollars more spendable.
Thank you, Chair Bryn Mowen, Councilmember Naker. Just quickly then, we have PED staff have done some research and found that peer cities have higher thresholds for prevailing wage and programs similar to our vendor outreach program for economic development projects than we do. So staff and city attorney's office have been meeting over the past year and a half to discuss kind of potential changes to exempt STAR projects from certain compliance areas. The next meeting about that is May 30th, so your input is timely. Any changes to this would be an ordinance change, so we're telling you about it today. It's not one of the things that you would be adopting on June 7th. We would be working, trying to move it through as quickly as possible so we can apply that change to this round of applications and moving that as we're going through the application process. But that's after application situation. So what we're proposing is, as you can see here, what the current thresholds are and what we're proposing. And based on 3 years of kind of STAR data, prevailing wage applies to 98% of current Neighborhood STAR awards and vendor outreach applies to 81%. These proposed changes would have resulted in compliance burden applying to about 29%. So it would be a significantly less of the awards would be required to go to meet those compliance. And I appreciate that the compliance thresholds are, like, the compliance requirements are there for a reason, but again, it's a balance of what makes sense. And just all of the people on this slide are here in the room, just to give you some names. I think you know everyone, but wanted to again acknowledge Nora and Grace is here, Aaron and Nancy is here, and then Angela Roch is here, and Jenny Wolf as well. We have project managers who are involved with every one of those projects. So it's a huge number of our, large percentage of our economic development staff. I would venture to guess that 75% of our economic development team's time is spent on STAR. Like that, it's like the department. It's a huge lift. And that is what I have for you today.
And just on the last piece, this is something that we've talked about, and I appreciate, Angela, your work in comparing us to other cities, that typically the thresholds that compel us to do prevailing wage apply to the amount of money that we're loaning or granting. And in St. Paul, for some reason, it applies to the total project cost.
Right.
So if we do, I mean, what project is $25,000? But we've had ones where we, there's a total project of $100,000. We loan 10.
Right.
And it triggers compliance for the whole project. And it can really be a barrier, again, especially in places where it's just challenging to get especially in this current construction environment, to get somebody to work on a $10,000 project and have compliance for a $100,000 project. Good luck getting somebody to sign up for that. So we're, again, just working on trying to find ways to honor our values, but at the same time right-size them to today's economy and to the experiences that we've had in just trying to get these dollars to the communities that we most want to serve. Mr. Tolbert.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing because I don't appreciate how this is framed. I don't view this as a compliance burden. I view this as the city's, when you take city money, you take city values. And the values are prevailing wage, which means we pay people what a prevailing wage should be, and that's a city value. Vendor outreach means we're trying to make sure that multiple companies that might have historically been not allowed are at least looked at. and affirmative action is similar. And so I just want to, I don't view this as a compliance burden. I view it as the city's values when you take city money. And as I've often said to people who have applied for STAR loans from businesses in my ward, they say, well, they'll call it a burden. I understand it's extra work. I don't disagree with that. But I tell them, I said, if you want city money, you take city values. Feel free not to take our money. So I'm not opposed to fixing this so that it is with the grant and that maybe not the total project cost. But I don't appreciate it being framed as compliance burdens, because these things are our values, just as we – as we've raised the minimum wage and done other things to try and bring equity to our economy. So,
Chair Bermon, Chair, Councilmember Tolbert, I appreciate that. Thank you for that.
Ms. Yang.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple of comments. I really appreciate the number breakdown for, like, how much staff time is spent on this. So it was really eye-opening for me, and I feel like that's also one of the reasons why we have to create urgency around making making changes to our program guidelines. And then the other thing I wanted to say is Nancy just has been so phenomenal in assisting my office every single time, including with our year-round STAR money. So I had to make sure I say that today. So thank you, Nancy. Really appreciate all that you're doing.
So much.
Yes,
thank you,
Nancy.
And she's managed this, like, there was a window of time between when Michelle left and Aaron came, and Nancy was on her own, and she did a great job, so we want to definitely lift her up for that. The last, I just want to mention, just because to kind of tie it together too, all of that, the when we're talking about maybe finding someone to kind of administer the program, we just have to figure that out, though, because the city would still have to be, like, deeply involved, and so we have to kind of figure out what we could, you know, how much sense it would logically make, and we will certainly look into that. I definitely think for the smaller grants, if we could have someone at least who administers just the smaller ones, like some of the neighborhood district councils do now. They'll apply for $50,000 loan, and they then have to manage the same, do all the same processes. So we just have to look at that. But it's definitely a good idea, so I want to add that. So we'll be back June 7th. We can talk in between. If there are things that we need to adjust before June 7th, let's talk about that. So I come with something that you're satisfied with, and we appreciate your time this morning.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for this overview, and also just that we have now a 2-week window to look at the first piece. And the second part with the compliance will be a little bit longer than that. I know that I have Mr. Vander already on my calendar to discuss the STAR board's perspective on this, and I encourage other people to do that as well. But just again, a reminder that we're trying. The one of the reasons why this is a fast and furious conversation is the STAR round's about to go out. And we know that we can't make it perfect before this round, but we know we can make it better based on the feedback we've gotten from the board, from our community, and from businesses. So hopefully this is a step in the right direction with a lot of opportunity to do bigger, bolder, better things with the program that suit our community. So
indeed.
Thanks for the
indeed.
Leadership here. And we will be in communication over the next few weeks as we move for the just in front of the council.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for your input.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there anything else? All right. Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Okay.
Yeah, so.